Good evening. We are continuing on in Proverbs tonight, talking about and trying to cover chapters 6 through 10. Sent out some questions, which we'll review here in a little bit as we go on. I have too many notes, as the emperor said. Too many notes. Last week, we talked a little bit about Solomon, where he fit in the birth order of David's named children. Talked about him as the primary source for the content. Talked about how others transcribed some of Solomon's writings and others contributed, namely in the final chapters of the book. When the scepter of rule passed from David to Solomon's hand, David's words of encouragement and exhortation echoed those of Moses and Joshua: be strong and courageous. And talked about how there was not much that we knew about this father-son relationship, David's relationship with Solomon, Solomon's relationship with his other siblings in that royal household. But the book of Proverbs conveys that David's instruction, both in that moment of the handover of authority, and more generally, it conveys that instruction, that teaching, left its mark on Solomon. And it was teaching he took to heart. This was advice he heard, and as the words of the book indicate, that he knew he should live by. Many of the chapters in the book are cast as fatherly, paternal counsel and orders, but maybe it could be interpreted as lessons from a king to those over whom he's ruling, and referring to the recipients of his teaching as son, which would indicate that he's giving a lot of focus to the young men in the kingdom. Now, this particular point might be an occasion for asking whether Solomon's saying how to live while living by another standard might undermine what he's teaching. I mean, in light of the course of Solomon's life, it seems like a natural question to have, a natural maybe allegation to throw. After all, you know, did he really put that much importance on heeding instruction and teaching since we saw him wander so far from it? And to borrow someone else's words, Solomon isn't the standard. And Solomon's adherence or lack of adherence doesn't affect the strength or the worth of the teaching that urges fidelity to the Father's words and teaching that stresses the pursuit of wisdom. We also talked a little bit about the fear of the Lord. Fear is what it means and encompasses reverence, the humility of our station, our role compared to God's role. And wisdom, that it is not just information gathering, it's not just knowledge gathering, it is understanding, it is knowing what to do, when to do it. It conveys recognizing, a recognition when something more is needed. And I brought up the example of Job and his response to his friends, that he said, look, here are the things that I've done, and if I'm missing something, if I need more information, if I need more righteousness, if there's something that's in between me and God, I want to know what that something is so that I can address it. And last week, I went ahead and gave some Proverbs of Washington. I've got more. Here's one more. So the lower the stakes, the fiercer the fighting. And I'm putting these up here. I put these up here as a kind of contrast between conventional wisdom or things that you need to bear in mind to try to keep your wits and keep your sanity in Washington, and the wisdom, the instruction that comes from Scripture in general, and particularly in the book of Proverbs, to adhere to cling to God's teachings and to let those be the guide for your life. So this time, as we're looking at chapter 6 in particular, there is a beginning to this chapter that is a little unusual. It struck me as a little strange in the telling of it. The New American Standard phrases the first few verses of chapter 6 this way: "My son, if you have become surety for your neighbor, have given a pledge for a stranger, if you have been snared with the words of your mouth, have been caught with the words of your mouth, do this then, my son, and deliver yourself. Since you have come into the hand of your neighbor, go humble yourself and importune your neighbor. Do not give sleep to your eyes nor slumber to your eyelids. Deliver yourself like a gazelle from the hunter's hand and like a bird from the hand of a fowler." What does it mean? What is this situation that Solomon has outlined and has urged the person reading this, the person hearing this proverb, the person hearing this teaching? What is being advised? What is the situation that is being described here? If you have become surety for your neighbor, have given a pledge for a stranger. Okay. Could everyone hear that? Taking up the legal responsibility to cover someone else's debt. Okay, and then what's the advice around that? If you have come into this situation in which you have taken on these kinds of responsibilities and have become snared with the words of your mouth, then plead with your neighbor, importune your neighbor, to do what? Importune your neighbor, plead with your neighbor to do what? To get out of it. Now, what does this advice amount to? What's Solomon instructing? What's he advising here? Watch what you promise. And if you find yourself snared, maybe that's a personal realization of not being able to cover whatever the debt is, Or it could be a situation in which you realize that the person for whom you've made the pledge has no intent, has no plans to do his part. So if you're the co-signer for the loan and the person taking out the loan is in a has given you some indication that that person has no intent to do anything to repay it, then Solomon's advice is to try to get out of that situation. What do you make of this? What do you make of this advice? Why would this be in here? Why would this advice be in the book of Proverbs? What is the lesson the Spirit wants us to glean from this kind of situation? What do you think?
It strikes me that this is an instruction about humility as being ready to acknowledge your mistakes and to take the steps that you need to take to rectify them. Probably in these the physical examples that he gives here, probably it would be embarrassing if you had made some kind of commitment like this, and then you had to go back and say, I can't meet this commitment, or I made a mistake. And perhaps the spiritual significance is greater to us than the idea is that you realize that you have erred. As soon as you realize that, you need to acknowledge it, not only to yourself, but to the person against whom you have erred. You need to acknowledge it to the Lord and to what you need to do according to the Lord to be right.
I think that's good insight. If once you are in a position where you recognize that you yourself are unable to uphold a pledge and a promise that you've made, having the humility to be able to acknowledge that to somebody, I think that's a really strong point, powerful point. Any other perspective? Yes, Jeremiah.
This one reminds me of 22:7, Proverbs 22:7. The rich rules over the poor, and the borrower becomes the lender's slave. And so that's generically, I think, two-person borrower-lender situation. So it's unwise to go into debt in general. But then, how much more unwise is it to say, I don't even know this stranger. This is a stranger, right? I don't even know this guy. But I'll take on a debt on his behalf. Or just maybe anybody. Why would it be wise to take on a debt on someone else's behalf,
and
you're not even supposed to take on debt on your own.
Yeah, good point. Any other thoughts there, Greg?
I think there may be an element of prevention here as well. The use of the words snared and caught is to, I think, highlight the kind of warning to watch out for this kind of situation and avoid it altogether from the outset. And then verse 4, just giving no sleep to your eyes, or slumber to your eyelids, has a sense of urgency with it as well. So avoid it altogether, but if you find that you have been snared and caught, then there's an urgency to try to rectify that.
Good. So humility about your own capabilities, a watchfulness about your circumstances, and urgency to make corrections as needed. And like the point Jeremiah made about being discerning, chicken scratch there, discerning about relationships that you enter into, particularly financial relationships in which you might find yourself subjugated to a lender, or you might find yourself financially strapped or tied to a tied up in a financial relationship that you don't want to be in and it's tough to get out of. So as I was, did you have a point to make? Yeah.
The thing that's interesting about Proverbs, the whole book, is that, there's of course a lot of spiritual lessons, of course, but there are a lot of just practical lessons too. And I think that sometimes it's there's double meanings. There's a practicality here, but there's a spiritual overtone or something to it. Because as y'all were talking, one of the verses that came to mind in the New Testament about not being unequally yoked to unbelievers and things along that line. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's talking exactly about what we're talking about here, but the concept is there to a degree. And being watchful about how you get into those situations. So whether you're talking about just from a pure physical standpoint, be wise with your finances. Don't get yourself in these situations, but there can be a spiritual aspect of that too, as to who you're getting in these situations with. And you might become, find yourself in a bad situation spiritually as well as physically.
It's a good point. Be prudent. Mm-hmm. Be prudent about what your resources are, whether much or little. Be cautious about entering into these kinds of relationships. Think twice about your own capability to uphold a pledge, and you might need to take a harsh look at someone who's asking you to guarantee a debt to cover a loan. Something that was kind of in the back of my mind about that, less elegantly phrased, is to beware of a get rich quick sort of scheme. And I think that to the extent that might be a valid application for these verses, it kind of goes into the next segment of verses about look to the ant, O sluggard. So to Tony's point, this worldly wise kind of practical advice criticizes or is a sort of a bulwark against trying to get around something, trying to get something for nothing, trying to get rich quick. And so there is this counsel to look to the end, who is always working, always preparing. Don't be focused on or obsessed with sleep and rest, but be ready to put in the effort that is due, and not trying to take too many shortcuts that might end up being dangerous and financially troublesome for you. All right. Something else I wanted to say. Oh, I thought the expounding here on a worthless person was helpful. I had not remembered that passage was there. And as we're reading through 1 and 2 Kings, there are some references to some worthless people. And as we go a little bit deeper into Kings, there are references to worthless people. And they seem to be very, very focused on the here and now, and not necessarily treating people fairly, not necessarily being truthful, but trying to maneuver and scheme for their own ends, and that doing so, having that kind of outlook, having that kind of attitude, is not subject to God's law. Just thinking about Romans 8, 7 and 8, the flesh being contrary to the spirit and not being subject to the law of God. All right. Any other comments about that segment there, the surety and looking at the end? Please, Jeremiah.
Yeah. I have had a tendency sometimes to think in terms of these are extremely dogmatic. In other words, never ever do these things, right? And so create a job away as you go and never partner. That's a general principle. Not always going to happen necessarily, right? And when you brought up the fact that maybe with the dishonest gain comment, the Good Samaritan did exactly this. Where he took the man to an inn and he said, here's some money, and whatever else he needs, you provide for it, and I will pay for it when I return. In other words, I'm indebted to you for whatever you say the price is to take care of it. Maybe it's a completely different ballpark, but it occurred to me, and it makes me think that we cannot use certain proverbs to get out of doing things, other things God expects us to do. Right? So if charity is a command, and the Good Samaritan was lauded as this example for what loving your neighbor looks like, then we need to kind of, there's a balance, maybe that's kind of what I'm getting at, right? So just a thought to throw out there.
Now, I see what you mean. Who know? That might have been something going through the minds of the Pharisees, who were focusing on this financial obligation that the Samaritan had put up for himself, because the Samaritan doesn't know the Proverbs. But at the end of that, Jesus' question is, who's the neighbor? Which one of these people acted like a neighbor? But I take your point. We need to be careful. We need to be cautious, aware, discerning about using Proverbs as cudgels to make some proof texting sort of point. Kind of tempted to jump ahead slightly, but I mentioned last week that there is a community dimension to the Proverbs, meaning that these pearls of practical wisdom and application help us to govern ourselves. Now I really am getting ahead. To govern ourselves. And might present occasions for brothers and sisters to approach us, or for us to approach a brother and sister that we think has maybe been a surety, you know, maybe too many times and has been taken advantage of. And something like this might be an occasion to say, let's pump the brakes, let's pause for a second. Might be an opportunity for reproof, for correction, to try to rectify a situation. For example, verses 16 through 19 are a delineation of things that the Lord hates. Any conclusions to draw from this? Any thoughts that came to you about getting a deeper grip, fuller understanding, something you've always heard or thought when reading these things that the Lord hates over the years?
So the conclusion is, stay on the path of righteousness and justice, you will be as concerned about these seven abominations. These are contrary to
God's ways and his nature and who he is. But it is good to read these, to be reminded that he detests these things.
So have these as a focus. And then as we do that, as we elevate those as our priorities, then we too will find ourselves hating these things. Tony?
Yeah, when I was reading these, all these things are things that are completely self-serving. It's all about me. And kind of dovetailing a little bit off what Danny just said is that, okay, what did Jesus say? Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Love your neighbor as yourself. Things like that where it's not about you. You come in last. You're putting everybody else before you. God's serious about that. Because, that the attitude is opposite of that in what's being described right here.
All right. Good. Bill?
It does seem to parallel what the vile person that's described in 12:15 would do. The other interesting aspect of it is how much of what's discussed in both 12:15 and 16:19 focus on the heart of the person. And so when you get to the New Testament, Jesus says it's out of the heart that either good or evil comes. We realize, he's reminding them of what they had either forgotten or chose to forget was the real purpose of the law. And here we see these books, what we call the books of poetry, which is that our hearts need to be devoted to God, and then necessarily won't be self-centered, right? You can't love God and not love your neighbor, right? That's John, the Apostle John, told us. So, it just reinforces how from the beginning, which Jason talked about on Sunday, from the beginning, God has wanted the heart of his people. And it's in the heart of his people that who they are is defined. And out of that heart comes these things that God abominates.
Evil thoughts, murders, adultery, Matthew 15, 17 through 20. Good. Millie.
It occurred to me and my sister and I talked about this. So, at the end of chapter 5, he talks about the wicked cry out for lack of the discipline. And the ignorant lack of discipline, surety, sloth, laziness, and then malice towards people, and then he does this. And all of those things, being undisciplined, leads us to sin. Being slothful leads us to sin. And to malice. They sort of build on each other. You don't just wake up one day and think, I'm a murderer. It builds on itself, and we allow our
focus on what it should be focused on. Nick?
I was going to say there's a relation between that aspect of humility and the aspect of doing these very selfish things, these things that would only advance yourself. The humility comes from a place of wanting to do more, wanting to do better, even if it's outside of your ability, whereas the other side is having the power but not accepting the responsibility.
Or not using it for good, but using it to get my way. The haughty eyes. I was looking up. So Wade's word lessons live rent-free in my mind. And I looked up that adjective in verse 17, haughty. And so the adjective comes from a verb about something being elevated, being placed over other things. And so just thinking about those eyes looking down condescendingly on other people. Lying tongue, out of the abundance of the heart. You know, to Bill's point, the mouth speaks. Hands that shed blood, out of the heart come murders. The heart itself devising wicked plans. Feet that run rapidly, you know, to Millie's point, feet don't move themselves, but there's, you know, intention and focus. A false witness who utters lies. One who spreads strife among brothers. I was thinking that, Danny phrased it a little more succinctly, but I was thinking about how the whole armor of God, if we take that as part of our, maybe as part of our daily prayer routine, I don't want to be overly prescriptive about that, but if our focus is on thinking about being girded with truth, protecting our heart with righteousness, wearing the helmet of salvation, taking the shield of faith, the sword of the Spirit, shoes for the preparation of the gospel, then we shield ourselves, kind of like we were talking about last week. The one who walks in the integrity of the Lord is shielded. We can set up a defense for ourselves against these attitudes, outlooks, desires, and actions that the Lord hates. Okay. So in the next stretch of verses, starting in 6:23 and going through the end of chapter 7, there's this extended warning against adultery. And this is one of those moments when I'm looking at the question and recognizing I probably had something particular in mind answer-wise about asking whether the term adultery is being used symbolically. But that moment has escaped me presently. And even in the prep, I was looking at it over the last couple of days thinking, what was I thinking there? So I'm calling myself out before you're able to.
You're not the only one that's
all right. Please,
point,
please.
A lot of this, there are literal references to adultery, but there is also this sense in which there is a contrast between an adulterous woman and a virtuous woman. And the adulterous woman symbolizes folly and lack of virtue and lack of righteousness and lack of discipline. And the virtuous woman represents the path of virtue and righteousness and doing the hard thing and self-discipline. So I think you're right. The virtuous woman and the adulterous woman do symbolize something greater than just sexual purity. They're just talking generally about the virtuous path and the foolish path.
So wisdom is in Hebrew a feminine noun, and so the pronounal reference to wisdom would be she or her. Sorry, I had to had to do that. I had to use pronouns in class. But so that's part of the reason that wisdom is referred to as her. And the pursuit of wisdom, as contrasted to the pursuit of folly, leads to a rich life, leads to right living, leads to righteousness. And I appreciate Wade making that point about the distinction between the woman of virtue and the adulterous woman as a contrasting situations and what the and contrasting pursuits. To the point, I think there is just a lot of very helpful warning, preparatory defense to being in a compromising situation, approaching an inappropriate relationship, being on guard for that. I mean, verse 32, chapter 6, verse 32, the one who commits adultery with a woman is lacking sense. He who would destroy himself does it. Bill.
So, Wade's philosophy, I believe, so I'm not going to disagree with him, that there's a higher subtext to that. And it's certainly true. Proverbs 1:20 uses this anthropomorphism.
Right.
I went to public school, but I don't know. Words more than two syllables. But
Susan B. Anthony Dollar for you.
That's right. But these, I think, are, we also shouldn't lose sight of. This is talk about actual adultery, and adultery has been a destructive threat to God's people back to the beginning. And, I mean, in the garden, it was spiritual. But once we get into later instances, we see the destructive effect of actual adultery. Whether it's masquerading as Sarah giving her handmaid to Abram, is that adultery? I don't know, but it brought destruction and strife. And then we see actual adultery in other places, and it continues today. So I think it is important to take that spiritual application, because God doesn't continually to Israel, you committed adultery against me, and Solomon's life showed that. He had all these women led him away from Yahweh into adultery with idols, so that's certainly true. At the same time, it's an uncomfortable conversation to have, but we need to be realistic about the fact that adultery, sexual adultery, continues to be a very destructive temptation to God's people. And I suppose you could debate whether it's more destructive to men than to women, and that's why Solomon has this extensive discussion to his son. But we need to be realistic about the continued threat that sexual adultery poses to God's people, especially.
To a point that you had made, Moses was pretty clear about not marrying among the tribes once we get to the promised land, because they're going to take you away. They're going to take you away from God. And, the speculative lobe of my brain was wondering how many times Solomon might have heard growing up from his mother about what we know as 2 Samuel 11, about David's treatment of Uriah the Hittite, and David's adultery with Bathsheba. And I wonder if that, just resonated with him as a particular you know, as a poignant evil maybe growing up. Jeremiah.
So I was thinking, I love your question about it. And I'm sorry if somebody made this comment, but I was trying to remember the Minor Prophet, so I was heads down. So I appreciate what Bill said, but Hosea was charged by God to go out and marry a prostitute who then went out and committed adultery on him, and then God said, go back and get her. Basically, beg her to come back. And God uses that as a symbolic, but it's also a symbolic example where God is telling the Israelites, you committed adultery against me. And so, yes, Proverbs 6 may be talking literal adultery, but on verse 25 it says, do not desire her beauty in your heart, nor let her capture you with her eyelids. When you think about the enticement of sin, lust of the eyes, lust of the flesh, and the pride of life, it is a pleasurable thing. That's what Hebrews says about Moses. He'd rather be an Israelite than enjoy the fleeting pleasure of sin. Adultery is a great symbol that God uses to explain the betrayal he feels when we allow ourselves to be enticed in sin. One of the last things Bill said is that he said, the constant, ever present nature of the adulterous woman, or the desire for her, that the same exists of sin. So not everybody is enticed by lust. There are plenty of other sinful natures that we cannot give into, but that some people struggle with different things. So I think it's a wonderful, terrible.
Powerful.
Powerful. There you go.
Awesome. I mean, yeah.
It makes you feel it when you're married. That really hits home, because what if my spouse were to commit adultery against me? Oh, wow, that's what happened. And that really kind of hits your heart.
Correct. Right. Right. And I was seeing some of these admonitions against adultery as a kind of commentary on the law of Moses, in the sense of not just, you know, not that there was anything wrong with the injunction against adultery, but Solomon says, you know, young man, she's going to be batting her eyes at you. So it, like I was talking about with that preparatory defense, that's one way to read and understand what's being passed along here. Does see another hand up over here? Okay. Sorry. Please, Jen. Right. Be discerning. Recognize that those around you may not have your interest, spiritual, financial, otherwise, at heart, and may be trying to take advantage of you. But you know, wisdom calling in the streets, chapter 1 of the book also says that you know, she's shouting in the squares, in the markets. How is it that wisdom does that? I mean, in a sense, it's an honest question because we're being bombarded with other messages, messages that are not wisdom, messages that are not deny self, follow God, messages that are not, you know, uplifting, upholding, honoring marital covenants, making sin look interesting, enticing, entertaining, rewarding. So in what ways now might we say that wisdom is shouting from mountaintops, is shouting in the market square to be heard, come follow me? Any thoughts? Say again.
Speaks to us about existence and that there is a curiosity inherent in each human being to find out. More to life than just what we can see. And to search out to be in search of the answers that you don't have, but you know they're out there, I think that's the search for the
beginning. So what I was going, the answer that I had been thinking about in response to that question is a little bit different from that. I'm not disputing what you're saying. But sometimes it takes the person to evaluate what he wants to listen to, what she wants to listen to, and ask whether that's a message worth listening to, worth following. I mean, that to Millie's point takes a lot of discipline, because if you're just hearing what's, I don't know, you're just going through life, you might think that's all there is, but it, you know, taking that moment to say, is this all there is? Who am I? Where do I come from? Where am I going? Those questions don't occur naturally to all people, but they're worth asking. And just because something is the only message that you hear doesn't mean it's the only message you should want to hear, should be listening to. Bill?
Well, 8 and 9, you reference both the beginning of 8 and 9. And parallel each other in the sense of wisdom seeking, and it is, can you trust it?
Yeah.
It has, it's reliable, we know that it will do what it is promised. And I think maybe the most familiar of all this is spirit preserving God's word through the ages. Is wisdom, James 1, right? Ask wisdom of God. God is
who gives generously, yeah.
Spirit has inspired men. Preserve the word to pursue men. And like wisdom and seeking people, it's there. Are we listening? It isn't something you have to go on a mountaintop and, you know, walk barefoot in robes or
right.
Can't eat locusts and candlestick. Word, wisdom is pursuing you, God is pursuing you. Will you listen? Because He's trustworthy and you can rely on Him and hear. Wisdom
right.
Really is standing in for God.
Right. There's that eternity-shaped hole in us that the things of earth, you know, can't fill. Yeah. Once again, didn't get through all the questions, but I appreciate everyone's comments, input. Thanks.